our Hamiltonian, which was constrained. And we started by trying to interpret the constraints. So to do that, we considered the smeared constraints, which are just integrated with respect to some function n or lambda. Using these as our basic variables with this Poisson bracket. And so to interpret it, we studied the flow with the Poisson bracket of our variables and the constraints. We found that the flow generated by lambda, or G, which was the Gauss constraint, would give us rotations in the internal indices. And the flow generated by the flatness constraint would give us translations. So then we had a third symmetry, which a priori was not related to our constraints. But it can be shown that, in fact, the diffeomorphism can be expressed as rotations and translations. This should be E, I think. Right, so the diffeomorphisms could be treated as rotations and translations as long as, you know, the T and F, the curvature and torsion, vanish, which they should. All right, then we looked at our constraint algebra to check if it's first class constraints or second class. And it turns out that they are, in fact, a closed algebra, so they are all first class constraints. And they, so this is actually the algebra rotations and translations. Right. So this looks like the SU2 algebra. And then this is like the commutator for generators of translation and rotation. And then this is just saying that translations commute. So the next step is to apply the Dirac program. But we can't really do that directly with these variables because they depend on your points in space-time. So you'd get something that's more distributional than you'd like. And maybe that's hard to quantize. So we're going to try to do something similar where we smear our variables over over surfaces and use those as our basic variables.
Yes, indeed. So it's what we're going to do today. So it's the first step of the Dirac program. As Peter remind us, the first step is to find representation of the phase space variable as operator in a given Hilbert space that, because we consider the variable before imposing any of the constraint, we talk about kinematical Hilbert space. Okay, so we consider the kinematical phase space, but again here, because of all this distributional feature, we're not going to use directly these variables. We're first going to define nicer variables that are going to be, that we're going to then find a representation of this other variable as operator. So in fact, we're going to spend some time on that. So that's why at the last week, I took the time to do a concrete example on how we apply the Dirac program to a specific system, which was this parameterized particle. Because we're going to see that now each step, more or less, is going to take one or two lectures. So you can be lost about into what are we doing now, why are we doing that, and where are we. So today, the first, the motivation is to apply the Dirac program. But for that, we need to find kind of nice variable, okay? So the first step is going to be, so here our configuration variable would be our connection. And as I said, something, a kind of recipe that work when we want to get rid of this distributional feature is to smear our configuration variable, on some k-dimensional hypersurfaces, and then the conjugated variable will be then smeared on a d minus k dimensional hypersurfaces, depending with d the dimension of our surface. So here d for us is equal to 2. And our configuration variable is the connection, and it's quite, so it's a one form, okay? So naturally it's going to be integrated over path, okay, over one dimensional object, because it's a one form. So for the configuration variable, we're going to define what we call holonomies. And we're going to see that we're really going to, in fact, even forget about connection, but really work. So here they're going to be integrated over one dimensional object, meaning a path. Okay, and we can define an holonomy. And here, so for a given edge, and we need a kind of orientation of this edge, we're going to consider the holonomy associated to this connection as the path order exponential of this connection. And because right now we, so here is the moment where we're going to decide, we need to decide if we work with SU2 or SO3, okay? Because up to now, so indeed, when we look at the interpretation of the constraint, we related them to the Gauss constraint, we related the Gauss constraint to rotation in 3D space, so we talk about SO3, okay? But again, what it's really doing, if you look at the constraint, it's really generated at the infinitesimal level. And at the infinitesimal level, meaning at the Lie algebra level, SO3 or SU2 are the same, okay? So of course, the finite transformation is going to be different if we talk about SU2 or SO3. The representation theory is also going to be different, but the representation theory of the Lie algebra is the same as the representation theory of the universal cover, and in the case of SO3, it's indeed SU2, okay? So the fact that SU2 is also kind of a simpler at the topologically, okay, because it's simply connected, so usually people work with SU2. Another advantage to work with SU2 is, as we mentioned, one motivation also to introduce this triad formalism was that in the metric formalism, you cannot add fermions, okay? You cannot couple fermions. And it's the same here. If you want to couple fermion, you have to work with SU2, because you want the spin or representation. Okay, so here, now, with what I said, here we're going to consider that this is a SU2 group element. And so, of course, I'm going to spend some time, because right now, what we've seen is that this object, or the triad with the co-triad, the densitized co-triad, will transform it as a vector under R3. So how is it transforming under SU2? And this we're going to work on that. So now the next step, since we decide to work with SU2 before going further into this definition, see exactly what this object means. What I want to do is kind of make the connection, look at the transformation of the densitized triad, the connection, and the curvature field under finite rotation in terms of SU2 group element. Okay, so here, because we decided to work with SU2, before moving forward, I just want to take the time to look at the transformation of the different field of interest under finite, so rotation in terms of SU2 group element. And here we're going to use what you use in the tutorial, one of the tutorials where you had to work on SU2 and SO3. okay? Where here, the idea was that you have a relation between the vector representation of SO3 TL and the adjunct representation of SU2. Okay, so this is kind of the fundamental relation we're going to use here. So here, I guess it's okay. Where G here are my SU2 group element. Okay, but, and here I mean the rotation associated to this SU2 group element. So this is the relation we have, okay? And so now what I'm going to do is to introduce, but this you did it a bit in the tutorial yesterday, and I think from what I've seen, most of you are familiar with the notion of Lie algebra valued object. Okay, so here I just want to so for example the densitized triad when there is no internal indices here, this means that this is contracted with a generator, SU2 generators, okay? So you can do that for all your variables. And we, let's look also at the curvature tensor that is also, this we haven't seen that yesterday, but, this one. Okay, well. SU2 generators. So they can be written in terms of the Pauli matrices. Usually we kind of normalize them a bit differently. Where here I need to remind you maybe that the densitized triad is just and so now I want to use that. So we've seen that usually this is a cotriad, but the triad is going to the triad itself is going to transform as a vector for the because it has a vector index. So for the rotation, so the rotation is rotation for internal indices, and we could show that it's the same for this object. Okay, so here, let's see now. If we get that the rotation, if we look at the rotation just on a vector, okay, on an internal vector, how this can be expressed in terms of SU2 group element. Okay, so the question is now, if we look at the rotation, so we want to use this, so I'm going to use this expression and contract the just index left with a vector for the internal index. So here we can call that internal vector. And so here on the other side, I just get that this is, so here by this point, I mean it's a matrix multiplication. And then we can apply that to our different object of interest. Okay, so let's work on that. So here, what does it mean here? This means that this, in fact, can be written as the inverse rotation acting on V, and it gives you the, so now it's a matrix multiplying a vector, and it's a component L. Okay, so from this new this equality, what we get now is that the action of a rotation on a vector is, so here, if it's the inverse, it's related to the inverse of G. So it's just here, I'm just writing. Okay, so what is that telling you? This tells you that for a vector transforming under a rotation, it's going the Lie value, the Lie algebra valued object is going to transform under the adjoint action by SU2. Okay? So here we can deduce from this equality, now we can deduce that this object is going to transform under the adjoint action of SU2. As well as, so here we haven't proved it, but you can prove that this object is also transforming as as a vector for SU2. So here you get the same kind of, of transformation. And the other object of interest, of course, is the connection. And here I'm not going to prove it, but you can go back to how it's transformed under a rotation, and then go to the what you have seen yesterday in the tutorial. And you can use, again, this kind of relation to show that for the connection, it's a bit more complicated. What we get is that we have the action by conjugation. Plus a derivative term that you've seen yesterday already in the tutorial, but written in terms of the SO3 matrix. Okay, so here you can check as an exercise. Check this last transformation. Okay, so this is just what I wanted to do first, because so now we work with SU2, so we need to write what is a gauge, kind of gauge transformation associated to SU2, okay, in terms of SU2. Yeah.
So I always get confused with that SU2 because the A's already have an index J.
Yeah.
And that J only lives in two dimensions, right?
No, it's three. Okay, so what is two dimensional? Here we're in 3D. Okay, so what is two dimensional is the A.
The A is the one that is two dimensional.
Yeah, because it's space. Okay, so the only splitting we do, and this is different in 4D, because in 4D, when you do the canonical analysis, in 3D, you only do the splitting of space time. Okay, you do this. Space and time, so 2 plus 1. What we say now is that the way we introduced the connection and the triad was really looking at G mu nu, okay? So mm-hmm. the space-time metric, and saying, oh, now I can write this metric instead of just looking at the metric. At each point, I can look at a small frame, and then this small frame has this internal rotation things, okay? And so this internal rotation, J take the index from 1 to 3, okay? It's SO3 or your SU2, okay? But it's at the level of the Lie algebra, so at the level of the Lie algebra, it's the same. And indeed, it's different in 4D, because in 4D, what is done is that in addition to the 3 plus 1 splitting of space-time, then there is a gauge fixing kind of at the level of the internal indices. Mm-hmm. Okay, where we consider this time gauge. And so indeed we in 4D, in fact, we also work with SU2. Okay, so it's the same gauge group because we have this gauge fixing.
Yeah. Okay.
But in 3D we don't need to do that because the theory is well defined like this. So we only do the space-time splitting, but no internal index splitting. So mm-hmm. here J take is a three-dimensional. Okay. Any other questions here? So now what does it mean that we work with this Lie algebra valued object? Okay. this kind of means that now the tangent space at each point in the spatial manifold can be identified with a Lie algebra SU2. Okay? So now tangent spaces at different points need to be related with each other, to each other. And for that, we need the kind of parallel transport, and this can be done using SU2 group element. And so let's maybe look at this, and this is going to, in fact, show how this holonomy, where this holonomy comes from. Okay? So this idea is now if we consider a given internal vector, okay, and I want to relate two internal vectors at two different points along a curve. So I'm going to call this curve gamma s, and then this is s equals 0, s equals 1. So let's consider that s go from 0 to 1, maybe for simplicity. Then on this curve, I know how to define the tangent vector that we will need in a moment. So let's so the idea is we start with internal vector at a point x, and we parallel transport to a point x prime or along a curve. And so the parallel transport of V can be defined as, so here, if you want at any point on the curve, V of S is going to be given. So here, the parallel transport of this object. And where here, this is the holonomy that go from gamma zero, so where we started, from the starting point, to so now the question is how. What is the gauge transformation associated to holonomy? Okay, and to see that, we can. So what we know is that under local gauge transformation, we know how this vector transforms. Okay, because it's just what we kind of proved here. If it's a vector, it's going to transform under this adjoint action. Okay, so here we know that under a local gauge transformation. So gauge transformation is always local. So what do we get? We get that V0 is going, so the V at S equals 0, so it's what I call V here, is going to be transformed as under gauge transformation, so with some group element living at this point. By adjoint action, it's what you've seen. And if now we look at the same vector but at the point S, it's going to be transformed by another group element that I call GS here. And so from that, the question is, can we guess what is the transformation, our holonomy is going to transform? And so here I can try to. So let's try not to get. So let's call that maybe V prime of S and this V prime of 0. Okay. So now the question is gauge transform for an holonomy. And I'm going to kind of find it using what I know. So what I know is how a vector is going to be transformed. Okay, so let's try to do that. So V prime of S is also related to V prime of 0 by another parallel transport. Well, here, the idea is that this is a gauge transform holonomies. So let's use what we have. So here, h prime of s, v prime of 0 is also g . So I'm just using this equation here. H prime minus 1. And so now I can compare. So I want to compare this with this new equation, with this other equation. Where here is g of s. And vs can be is written in terms of v0 the same way, using the parallel transport. So the holonomy. Okay, so now here I should be able to conclude this is related to here. So what I get is that h prime of s, so h of s is going to be gauge transform as a group element living at S, H of S, group element living. So if you run, this can be rewritten as more specifically. This is, what does it mean? This means that this is the holonomy going from gamma 0 to gamma S. Okay, so in fact, properly, I should write that this is living at. This is not really well written. So it's in fact living at gamma s, h of s, g of. Okay, it's of course related to the path we are working on. Okay, so this is a gauge transformation. And so you see that here you have two different holonomies for the connection. Okay, and this. Okay, so here you have two different objects, but of course this is if you want to work, you can relate that to the fact that here you have this derivative term. Okay, so this was kind of expected that you don't get the same. Okay, so this is the gauge transformation for our new object, basically. And so now let's maybe take the time to really understand what this means here, why I'm telling you that the holonomy can be written like this. And so for that, any questions first, maybe, on this? Okay, so again, what we're doing now is really the first step of the Dirac program, and it's to find the right variable we can work with. And the first one is this holonomy. Okay, so the first step was to understand how this holonomy is going to transform under gauge, this SU2 gauge transformation. And now let's kind of define, see how we get this expression up. Okay, so definition of so if again we're going to take the example of parallel transporting a vector v along a curve, and so if v such a vector is parallel transported, what does it mean? This can be translated. Then it simply means that the covariant derivative where here, so this is the tangent vector. So we're going to define the derivative along the curve. So the derivative along the curve of this vector is equal to zero. So now just the derivative, the covariant, so I defined what was this gamma dot here. Now, I should mention that gamma dot and here we're going to, since we're working with the algebraic valued object, I'm just going to remind you what is the expression here. So this you can really get it. You remember if you were looking at the covariant derivative for a vector with an internal index, what we are getting was this epsilon ijk, okay? And this epsilon ijk can be obtained by the combinator between two SU2 generators here. So indeed, here we can just recast this into a commutator, okay? Where here, of course, this, again, is a Lie algebraic valued object, so it's multiplied by this, by two SU2 generator, and the commutator is what is going to give you the epsilon, okay, that you were, that I was giving you in the previous expression. Okay, so now let's expand this and see what we get. So if I'm expanding this term, so I first have just the derivative, and I'm going to write that V of S, of course, can be written as, because I want an equation on my, so my point now is to define this holonomy, so I need to find an equation defining the holonomy, okay? So I'm using what I know about the fact that the parallel transported vector on the curve satisfies this equation, and the relation of this vector with the SU2 group element to find an equation of my on my holonomy. Okay, so here, if I expand that, so Vs is going to be defined this way. What I get is that the derivative with respect to S, now the only S dependence is going to be in the holonomies. The V is just a vector at the origin of my. Then I'm getting a minus sign coming from the action of the derivative of the inverse, okay? So here I'm just getting h of s v0, and then h inverse okay, so here you know how to get that. You know that H and H inverse is equal to identity. So the derivative of the identity is zero, and then you just expand the product of, okay, of these two things. And so that's why you get this multiplication by the inverse matrices here and the minus sign. Here it's just by doing and expanding that, okay, this term. Okay, so then I'm still missing the commutator terms, okay? So here, if I write that explicitly, what I get is something like this. So where again, minus the other term, so the commutator with this, V0, one, and then so this is equal to zero. And so from here we define, we if you so look carefully at this equation, you can simplify, and what you get is the defining differential equation. For the holonomy. Okay. Okay, and so what we get here is exactly that the derivative minus a living at point s time h of s. Okay, and I guess you've seen that in, and of course we have an initial condition because at the point gamma zero, h of zero is also identity. Okay, so this is something you, I guess you've seen, even in quantum mechanics, I think we've seen this equation. So the solution here is well known, and it's indeed the path ordered exponential, okay? Where now when we write this A over there, it's mean A of S, in, and it's the contraction of gamma. The solution. Here we have the well-known and if you never did that, you can just work with you should do it, and it's by iteration. Okay, so here again, you get this over gamma, where A of S is and so from now on, we're really going to forget about the connection and just work with holonomies. Okay? And in fact, yeah, connection is really a very natural function of the holonomies. And you're going to see in the next tutorial that it's going to give a kind of a measure of the curvature. Okay, looking, so it also has a nice geometrical interpretation. And moreover, we've just seen that it has a kind of very simple behavior under gauge transformation. So we still need to define the Smirn conjugated variable, and then check the Poisson bracket between all these variables, that all these variables are going to form an algebra, a nice algebra that we're going to be able to quantize. But before going to the definition of the Smirn conjugated variable, I'm just going to give you a kind of the list of the nice property of these holonomies. Okay, so one of the first one is this simple transformation under gauge transformation. You're going to see in tutorial that it has a nice geometrical interpretation because it allows you to measure really the curvature. But so let's now just take the time to see some important property of the holonomies. So first, I think maybe to show that in the tutorial, the definition of this holonomy is independent of the parametrization of your path. Okay? So this is kind of nice. Your path, like that here I call gamma. Usually we're going to switch to notation because then, of course, having many paths together, we're going to talk about graphs at some point. And so we're going to call this, we're going to go to, for each edge of a graph, we're going to have a SU2 holonomy, okay? then the autonomy is kind of a representation of what we call the groupoid of oriented paths. So what does it mean here? This means that the autonomy of a path defined by just a single point is going to be the identity. This is, and then if you have, so how do I write this? If gamma is a point, then you get, then you also have a nice multiplication. So if you have two oriented paths now, okay, connected, E1 and E2, then you can of course consider only one path, E, the associated path. And here, H associated to the long path is really just the product of the two. And so here we use the multiplication on the right. So it's a SU2 multiplication here. And of course, we have also a notion of inverse. And this is going to be used. So since we talk about oriented edge or oriented path here, okay, so if we now change the orientation of our path or go the other way, the autonomy associated to it is going to be just the inverse. We're here, instead of choosing this orientation, you choose the other orientation. You have this nice relation. Okay, so this first object are really nice, of course. The aim is to get, so to do the Dirac program is not only to have, so here this was to replace, so we did the first part of the recipe I gave you, okay, so we smeared the configuration variable over a one-dimensional object here. So since we are in 2D, we expect that, so D minus K here is going to be 2 minus 1, so we just get also that the densitized triad is going to be smeared over also one-dimensional object. Okay, so in 4D, you can see that already this is going to be different because in 4D, so you have the 3 plus 1 splitting, so you work on a three-dimensional space. The holonomy are going to be defined the same, so these objects are going to be the same. It's also going to be SU2 holonomies, but the flux, what we're going to call the flux variables, that are the smeared conjugated variable, okay, associated to this densitized triad, are going to be smeared over surfaces, okay? So here, it's going to be smeared over graph again, or edges, or path, I don't know, you want one-dimensional object, and in 3D or 4D, it's going to be over surfaces. Okay, so this is going to be one of the differences between this 3D and 4D, but the holonomies are the same. So everything I said here is not related to the fact that we are in 2 plus 1 or 3 plus 1. Okay, and of course, something that is really important, because why are we doing all this is because you remember that, so if we start just with the connection and the densitized triad here, what we call, so the algebra of this variable, so it's really distributional, okay? So the Poisson bracket between A and E is with this delta of x, y. So here we do all that to get rid of them, but at the same time, what we want is still a nice algebra, okay, of variables, because you remember that from the Dirac program, what you expect is that the Poisson bracket become commutators, and so this means that kind of the Poisson bracket are kind of quantized in a way. Okay, so let's move to. And so maybe just one remark, because from here you can see that, so we haven't talked yet really much about in which Hilbert space we're going to work, okay? But you can already kind of guess that at least one Hilbert space we're going to consider is going to be a Hilbert space associated to a given graph, okay? Because you can see that, or even a given edge. And of course, it's not the complete theory that we're going to describe with that Hilbert space, but it's quite of similar to usually what you're doing. We will be doing anyway in QED or QCD. You always start with a truncation, okay, of your theory. So in QED, usually you start with maybe the Fock space associated to one particle, and then you go to n, and then at some point maybe you take n goes to infinity. And in QCD, you will work with a given lattice, and then you will look at more refined lattice to kind of take a limit. So of course here, what we're doing at the end, what we're going to get is we're first going to work on this kind of Hilbert space that is truncated with a kind of finite number of degrees of freedom. And then at some point, we will have to take the limit. But of course, most of the things we're doing are going to be working with this truncated Hilbert space, okay, where we're going to work at the level of a given graph and then see what we can learn from here. And at some point, I'm going to mention this notion of limit. But in practice, we almost, yeah, we never really take it in practice, and especially in, okay, but so before going about this, talking about this Hilbert space, we are not at the quantum level yet. We're just at defining our classical variable that are kind of nice. So now let's go to the conjugated variables. And here I'm, which are going to be the fluxes. Okay, and here, since I don't have so much time, I'm going to give you the expression. So it's going to become a bit maybe not very clear what I'm doing here for the moment. So, but you remember, so we, for the holonomy, we have this graph, okay, we have this path, gamma, and let's say that this is gamma zero. And it's parameterized by S. We remember that the parametrization is not going to be important because the definition is independent. But so we have on, now I'm going to have an holonomy defined on this curve, along this curve. And the flux variable is going to be also defined on using the densitized triad and smearing over a one-dimensional object, so smearing over another path. And we're going to define that the flux, so it's going to give what we call the flux variable, are going to be also sitting at this point. So you see that now we're dealing with kind of non-local objects, so we need to kind of say where the objects are sitting. So here we define the flux sitting at gamma zero, and it's going to be defined where here I'm going to introduce the notion of a dual curve, okay? Maybe I wrote too much thing. So here it's the support for this holonomy. And now I'm going to introduce a dual curve. And it's not going to be only the smearing of the densitized triad. I'm also going to use some parallel transport here. So first, because I want this object to be sitting at this point, and you see that here I'm going to integrate over this curve. But also it's going to allow to have this object to have a nice behavior under gauge transformation. Yeah? And also a nice, we are going to have a nice algebra of variables here. Okay, so what is this holonomy? So I want to parallel transport from the point gamma star of S, any point here, to to gamma zero here. Okay, so I'm going to use my Paris transport to go from any point on this curve to my point where I want my object to sit in. Okay, so this is why I get this kind of complicated expression. So here, this point initially is living on the curve. And again, here I'm using Lie algebra valued object. And then, so it's a parallel transport, so I need to use this new action. So where this is the autonomy, the parallel transport, from on gamma star to. So as a convention here, the convention we choose is that the crossing here is happening is kind of transversal, okay, and is not happening at one of the endpoints, okay. Otherwise, we get some more complicated feature, and we can even choose. We're going to see that when we look at the behavior of this variable, it's really just a convention, and then it's going to be independent of this convention. So we can even choose that here S is equal S prime if here it's a S prime for this curve, okay, is equal kind of 1/2, okay? But here, this is just convention, and so it's a choice. We, at some point, to do explicit calculation, we need to kind of define how these curves are crossing. So we choose this, and we also choose that the tangent vector at the intersection are positively oriented. Okay, so that the determinant here of these things right here is a dual curve. Okay, so this just gives you an information on the tangent vector at this intersection. But this is just convention, just to simplify when we're going to compute explicitly the Poisson bracket between these different objects. And so here, there are some remarks that are important. So why we are inserting this holonomy here? This holonomy allows that we have a local transformation, which is nice under internal rotation. So now, if this is my flux variable, then it's going to just transform very simply. So as I said, this flux variable is living at the starting point of my curve, which where I define my holonomies. Okay, so these variables are conjugated variables, so that they are related is kind of expected. And here it's kind of a local transformation we have. These two group elements are living at the same point. And so why we're using as a starting point, the starting point of gamma rather than to gamma star, it's just because then it's allowed to have that the relation, the transformation relation for the flux and the holonomy are going to be nicely related. So this you're going to see that later. And so if you remember that we have that H gamma inverse, so meaning that I reverse the orientation of this edge here is going to be related to the inverse matrix here, we can show that we have something a bit similar for the flux associated to the, when we change the orientation here, it's just going to be given by with a sign. Okay, so this object is now a Lie algebra valued object, so we need usually to extract a component to make any kind of calculation, but I'm not going to do that now. We just what I'm going to tell you. Oh, I can show you. Yeah, so to extract component, I think you've seen that in the tutorial. You just use the fact that the trace of give you a delta here, where again, yeah, I didn't really remind you what was this object. So yeah, well, this is because I'm using this convention. And so thanks to that, we can just extract a component of this. So the component J is just given by, so I have a minus 2 that is going to come out because of this normalization thing. But if I take the trace of E, so here it's gamma J. Okay, so it's a way. So when I'm talking about the component of this object, this means that I'm taking the trace times a generator here, associated generator. OK, so just to conclude, I'm going to check that the Poisson bracket form a nice Poisson algebra. So I'm just going to give it to you. And I'm not sure I'm going to prove it next time. Then here, between the different M prime and prime, so the component, of course, these are going to still commute. And now the flux variable satisfies this new algebra. So this is just for one given a path here, K. And of course, this, what I mean by here, it's by component. So here it would be more component by component that this equation holds. Okay. And so what is nice about this algebra is that it's closed. So it gives you that the phase space associated to one given curl is kind of well known. This is what we call T star of SU2. It's a cotangent bundle of SU2. And and we're going to see that this phase space I also even classically has some nice geometrical interpretation, but also it's going to be easy to kind of quantize. Okay, so I'm going to stop here, and tomorrow we can really start talking. So I don't think I'm going to prove this. This is a kind of, this is a bit painful. If you want to see, I can give you references, but I don't think I'm going to do that on the blackboard. It's kind of, so why it was really useful to give you kind of these details about the convention we use to say how these two curves are going to cross was more if in case we wanted to do explicitly this kind of calculation. Otherwise, it's not really useful because this is totally independent of this thing. The only thing that is important here is really this given edge, okay?